This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
By 2030, around one in five children in Africa will be born into, raised in poverty. And so the immediate thing that needs to happen is that we need to lift these children out of acute poverty.
That's Kevin Watkins of the Overseas Development Institute. Details coming up.
Also, the UN Children's Fund reports the humanitarian crisis in Nigeria and in three other countries in the Lake Chad Basin is getting worse. And traders fear businesses could collapse in Burundi if the fuel shortage that has gripped the country continues.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the UN says about 500,000 children in Nigeria and three other countries in the Lake Chad Basin will suffer from severe acute malnutrition this year. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, reports the humanitarian crisis is getting worse. Regional Director Manuel Fontaine calls it a crisis that ranks high on the global migration and displacement agenda. He says relief efforts are not able to reach more than 1 million children due to continuing conflict between regional militaries and Boko Haram militants. Military forces from Nigeria, Niger, Chad, and Cameroon are waging an offensive to retake major portions of the Lake Chad Basin. UNICEF says in addition to 2.6 million people currently displaced, more than 2 million others may be trapped in areas that remain under Boko Haram control. Half of them are children. UNICEF adds that Boko Haram, which has abducted many civilians, has used nearly 40 children as suicide bombers.
A new report says children in Africa may account for nearly half of the world's poor by 2030. That prospect is the result of rapid population growth and continued poverty. It poses serious problems for the continent. For VOA in Abuja, Chika Adua reports on what some say might be the solution.
The song says, "Get it together and plan well." It was released earlier this year to promote something that is still controversial in Nigeria, family planning. Nigeria is Africa's most populous country with more than 170 million people and growing fast. A new report by the London-based Overseas Development Institute says the population boom, coupled with existing poverty and extreme inequality, are a dangerous mix. ODI says over the next 15 years, the African child will emerge as the face of world poverty. Kevin Watkins is one of the researchers of the report.
By 2030, around one in five children in Africa will be born into, raised in poverty. And so the immediate thing that needs to happen is that we need to lift these children out of acute poverty.
Activists say family planning is a key component of meeting that goal. Nigeria alone will account for 6% of all global births between 2015 and 2030, the report says. The UN projects that by 2050, Nigeria will surpass the United States to become the world's third most populous country, behind China and India.
Is this a blessing and a curse?
Felix Obi is a development policy analyst in Abuja.
We have the potential of having a very large pool of skilled workers if government invests properly in education and building human capital.
If the population keeps growing and the government is not investing in the education of young people, it's a recipe for chaos in the future.
In Nigeria, women on average give birth to 5 children, but it's not uncommon to find 10, 14, or even 20 children in a household, in particular in areas where polygamy is practiced. Birth control remains a sensitive subject.
More of like religion, one of the basic things that they say that you cannot control birth because it's God would give you and God will provide.
Even so, Public health worker Bintu Kanto said she meets women who tell her they want to have less children, but they don't know how. A key challenge for women in Nigeria is not just getting access to birth control pills or injections, but paying for them. The Nigerian government committed to allocate an additional $8.35 million annually to family planning in 2012. That was on top of its existing $3 million annual commitment. Family planning activist Chinwe Onumonu is lobbying for follow-through.
Basically, to increase funding for family planning and also to get the government to redeem its commitment he made at the London Summit in 2012. So what we have tried to do is to first track, do an assessment of the bottlenecks within the Ministry of Health.
Contraceptives arrive in Nigeria via the seaport in Lagos. But according to Obi, there often isn't government money to transport them to local public health facilities.
Procurement is just one bit of it, it's just the beginning. But for it to be used and get to the end user, so logistics comes in, then the advocacy, sensitization and that bit comes in as well. So states are supposed to be able to take care of some of these costs.
The federal government passed a record $30 billion budget this year. Only 4% was allocated to health, and out of that, family planning programs received a mere 0.3%. Activists say the government cannot continue to rely on donor agencies to meet its needs. Even Nigeria's First Lady has called for more commitment and funding for family planning services. Chika Odua for VOA News in Abuja.
Burundi has been hit by a fuel shortage for almost a week now. Traders fear businesses could collapse if the shortage continues. Moses Habayarimana reports from Bujumbura.
Most of the fuel stations in Burundi open for just a few hours and sell a limited amount of petrol to customers. In Bujumbura, residents fear that the food and transport costs could sharply rise. Shaban is a taxi driver in the capital.
He says,
to get fuel now, you will not work for the whole day because you have to queue for more than 6 hours at the petrol station that is distributing fuel. He says sometimes he ends up not working for the whole day, only queuing at the petrol station to get fuel, and that he has to bribe some attendants at the petrol station to escape the long queue. Burundi consumes approximately 12 million liters of fuel per month. Eric is a fuel distributor at a Bujumbura petrol station. He says they are slowly distributing fuel at the petrol station, which is well known in Bujumbura. He says most of the petrol stations are not operating due to shortage of the fuel, and that the shortage was caused by the lack of foreign currency in the country. Burundi's local currency depreciated against foreign currencies, and the United States dollars in particular. The Burundi Central Bank has taken some measures to stabilize the exchange rate. According to the Central Bank, the average inflation rate is around 3% since January. Fuel importers who preferred not to be identified said that the scarcity of foreign currency has contributed to the fuel shortage in the country. Ndayihaye Norask is the general director in the Burundi Ministry of Energy and Mines. He says the fuel that arrived over the weekend was not offloaded. That was one of the main reasons for the fuel shortage, and it created panic among the public. He says after meeting with all the fuel importers in Burundi, there still proved to be an issue of scarcity of the foreign currency in the central bank reserves. The shortage of foreign reserves in the central bank comes after the European Union and United States suspended direct financial support to the Burundian administration. This included budget support. However, financial support for humanitarian assistance was not affected. Currently, most of the foreign exchange bureaus in the country are closed. The few that are open have little or no clients after the Burundi Central Bank's imposition of lower exchange rates. Now, the black market sells or buy the dollar at the rate of 40% lower than the central bank. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
15 past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Wars and civil unrest in the eastern Mediterranean region are reversing the health gains made over the past 20 years. A new study says deteriorating conditions in Syria, Yemen, Libya, Tunisia, and other countries are expected to continue for years to come. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
Dr. Ali Mokhtad says until fairly recently, the Eastern Mediterranean had made gains in health and life expectancy.
Historically, that region hasn't been stable. There's been a lot of war and unrest. But from 1990 to 2010-11, before the so-called Arab Spring or Arab Uprising, there was a tremendous improvement in health, so life expectancy, and the countries were doing very well.
There were several reasons for the health gains.
One of it is there is a flourishing private sector that people rely on, and they fill the gap of what the governments are not able to do or do correctly. The second is the resilience of the people. And I mean, there is a family support. There is a tribal system in that region where if somebody is sick, the family will put resources in order to make sure he or she will get better care.
Dr. Mokhtad is director for Middle Eastern Initiatives at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. It's part of the University of Washington in the western U.S. city of Seattle. He says ongoing conflicts in Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and Libya, as well as political uprisings in Egypt and Tunisia, brought the trend of better health to an end.
What we are seeing, a decline of health services and a reverse of all of these success stories. And what is sad about it and why we are screaming is at a time where every country in the world is seeing a decline in infant and maternal mortality, Syria, which was a pioneer, for example, in achievement in these two, declining infant mortality and declining maternal mortality, is seeing a rise in both of them, is seeing a decline of life expectancy of 6 years. And that's really sad.
Millions of people in the region have been displaced. Infrastructure, including water and sanitation systems, have been destroyed. Preventable diseases are spreading, and there may be no vaccination programs to stop them. Often, when attempts are made to resume immunizations, health workers are attacked. Polio, once again, is a major concern. Very rare skin rashes, diarrhea, and lower respiratory infections have become common. Cases of mental illness and drug abuse are rising as well. The region has what Dr. Mokhtad calls a gloomy future. He says there's a generation of people who do not have the same protection against disease that their predecessors had. For that, he says, you need electricity and good roads and bridges. Conflicts and uprisings have also led to a brain drain in the Eastern Mediterranean. Many health professionals and scientists have moved away.
So a physician in Syria, for example, who's board certified in the United States, has already left, and he or she is working in the United States right now. And then all the rich people are leaving and opening businesses somewhere else. We see it in other countries in the Arab world, in Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan. And then the war has depleted all the resources of the government.
The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation warns of potential disease outbreaks during the Hajj, the annual mass pilgrimage by Muslims to Saudi Arabia and Iraq. Saudi Arabia set up health screenings and clinics during last year's Hajj. This year, it will have many doses of Tamiflu on hand for anyone showing the symptoms of the flu. But Mokhtad says the Hajj lasts for days, giving time for disease to spread. When asked what can be done about the rising health problems in the Eastern Mediterranean, he said,
first thing is, you know, a cry for, sorry, I'm a little bit emotional now, a cry for everybody in the world to stop that madness. These wars cannot go forever. To see a picture of a Syrian kid dying on a beach or a Syrian kid dying in Syria, so basically you flee, you die, you stay in your country, you're facing a terrible, we need to stop this madness.
Dr. Mokhtad says when the madness eventually does stop, a roadmap will be needed to rebuild infrastructure. He says donors must then make long-term commitments to provide funding. He worries that when the conflicts end, and the media coverage along with it, that these countries could be forgotten. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Human Rights Chief Zayed Raad al-Hussein says millions of civilians face unbearable suffering due to the ongoing conflict in Yemen. The High Commissioner for Human Rights has issued a new report calling for an independent investigation into rights violations by armed groups in Yemen. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations estimates nearly 3,800 Yemeni civilians have been killed and more than 6,700 wounded since March 2015. That is when the Saudi Arabian coalition, which supports the government, began its bombing campaign against the Houthi rebels. The report says the escalating fighting is taking a devastating toll on the civilian population. It reports 7.6 million people, including 3 million women and children, are suffering from malnutrition, and at least 3 million people have been forced to flee their homes. The chief of the Middle East and North Africa section of the High Commissioner's office, Mohammed Ali Ansour, tells VOA all sides in the conflict are involved in serious violations and abuses.
There was targeting of civilian objects protected by the international law, like markets, like wedding ceremonies, hospitals, facilities that really, under the international humanitarian law, is protected and have special kind of protection, legal protection.
The report documents several attacks in which no military objective could be identified. In numerous situations where military targets could be identified, it says the minimal gains from these attacks cannot justify the serious loss of life and injury to civilians and civilian infrastructure. High Commissioner Zayed says the perpetuation of the conflict and its consequences on the population in Yemen can no longer be tolerated by the international community. He is calling for an end to the impunity enjoyed by those responsible for the violations and abuses against the civilians. He says those found guilty must be held accountable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Reuters news agency reports that Zimbabwe's agricultural minister has been ordered to fire more than 8,000 government workers due to the country's big economic problems. The state-run newspaper, The Herald, says the Public Service Commission ordered the Agriculture Ministry to cut half of its workforce. The commission hires all state workers. A ministry official says the payroll cuts would jeopardize the nation's ability to feed itself during a severe regional drought. The government of President Robert Mugabe is short of cash and has struggled to pay its more than 300,000 salaried civilian workers. All government salaries, in addition to police and military, consume more than 80% of the national budget. The cash crisis has fueled recent demonstrations against Mr. Mugabe, who has ruled Zimbabwe for 29 years.
The report warns of the dangers of the uncontrolled growth of invasive species. It shows how harmful plants and non-native species can spread dramatically, altering landscapes, ecosystems, and human livelihoods. The worldwide analysis was undertaken by Purdue University and other institutions. Jeffrey Dukes is a professor of forestry and natural resources and biological sciences at Purdue University in the state of Indiana. He is also one of the lead authors of the study. He says unless developing countries respond to the threat, invasive species could endanger their food security.
Invasive species are just species that have been brought from one region of the world to another. So they've gotten there with some sort of human assistance, and they have thrived there, and different people have different different definitions for exactly what is the threshold for an invasive species, but a lot of people consider it to be a species that has thrived to the extent where it's caused problems, whether those are ecological problems or economic problems. It could be an agricultural weed that's causing big problems. It could be an aquatic plant that clogs up waterways. It could be a disease that maybe kills one species in particular, but knocks an important species out of a forest because it just becomes so prevalent. There are many different types of invasive species, but it's really just something that's been transported to a new region, caused ecological or economic problems in that region because it's gone out of control.
Your research has shown invasive species in both developed countries as well as developing countries, and you also noted there's an emerging trend of invasive species in developing countries. So first of all, what is the threat for developing countries?
Developing countries have a variety of threats, really. One is that they don't tend to have as strong a level of protection against new invasive species coming in as developed countries. So there hasn't been as much thought necessarily placed and as many resources in developing countries poured into identifying invasive species that could become problematic, keeping them out and combating them once they get in. And then, of course, in developing countries also, you have populations that tend to be more susceptible to the problems caused by invasive species. So there are fewer resources for an individual person to combat them on their land. So if they're a farmer, for instance, and they have weeds coming in, they might have less resources available to take care of them. And there are just fewer resources available as a cushion as well to sort of buffer them against the maybe economic losses that could result from the invasive species getting there. So, I mean, a lot of these invasive species you can think of as just being weeds that get into farm fields or weeds that take over pastures where people graze their animals. People in the developing world are much more closely connected to nature and depend much more on the benefits of nature than people who are in the more developed countries do.
With resources being so low in these developing countries, what are some cost-efficient ways that they can combat invasive species?
I think one of the things that these countries could do is work with their neighbors, try to identify what species are most likely to be problematic in those countries, and maybe figure out a cost-effective way to screen for those, whether it's a survey for people coming in off the airplane, be a little bit more rigorous in terms of customs, essentially, and being aware of what's being imported, and promote awareness of species that are really problematic in neighboring countries.
This research that you all have done is really the first global analysis regarding invasive species. What do you hope to accomplish with this?
What we've done here is we've mapped places where we think the invasion problem could get a lot worse going forward, and we've mapped places that we think are relatively unprepared or unable at this point to deal with invasive species, and that really includes most of Africa. Going forward, you know, it would be really nice to have a better map of where different invasive species are, where they're most problematic, but I hope that really what they'll do is use this as a tool to take a hard look at whether they're as prepared as they can be based on the resources they have available to deal with these problems, and maybe use this as a tool to talk to international agencies, talk to their neighboring countries, and become more prepared, and to use it as an opportunity to talk with people within the country about this problem and make individual farmers and people who are depending on the landscape a little bit more aware of some of the potential issues that could be coming in the future as we continue to change our environment and potentially make our environment around the world more susceptible to invasive species that arrive.
That was Purdue University professor Jeffrey Dukes. He spoke with me from West Lafayette, Indiana.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. Some things change. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC, GMT, right here on VOA Africa.